welcome to Money Matters. My name is Mark Cuniberti. I'm glad to be here today. Today's show is number 330, entitled Open Up America. And yes, we are opening up. But before we begin, remember, discussions in this show should not be construed as specific recommendations or investment advice. Always consult with your investment professional before making important investment decisions. Indices I may mention are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly, and past performance is no guarantee of future results. And remember, the views expressed today are my opinions only. They do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its staff members, or underwriters. Money Matters is about money, as money does matter, and matters of money affect us all in some way or another. Whether you have a lot of it, a little of it, or none of it, it controls our economy, our country, our planet, and in some way or another controls the very way we live our lives. It's about your money, your lack or abundance of it, your lives and our livelihood. Of course, in short, Money Matters is about you. Open up America. So here we go. We are opening up. Wow. Been a long time, huh? Over a year. Shut down in March, of course. And the markets had come off a high of around 29,500, somewhere in there, about mid-February. And starting like the third week of March, started to plummet, and in 3 weeks, they went from a very recent new high of 29,500, plummeted to bear market territory, which was down 40% almost on the Dow to 18,200-something in 3 weeks, if you remember that. We forget how badly crashes feel, but wow. We published both in article and on the show, and with the approval of regulators, that in the mid-February, we said that they weren't taking this virus seriously, and we were kind of looking for a reason to sell in our portfolios because it was at a new high, and we were a little concerned that the Trump tariffs were going to knock a few percentage points off of Chinese GDP, gross domestic product. And if it knocked off more than 2% off gross domestic product in China, it was rumored the market was going to sell off hard, and I was concerned. So I was looking for an excuse to sell and take some profits where they existed from the run-up from 2016. I wanted to protect any profits we may have had, and was looking for an excuse to sell and lock those in. And then I got some photographs late March of a city in China, from an acquaintance of mine, that the city airport was vacant, and the city was vacant. And he said, we have this virus, which had kind of started hitting the news, called coronavirus. And when I saw those empty photographs in China, I thought, wow, you know, here we are worried about the Trump tariffs knocking 2 percentage points off of Chinese GDP. But what about this? So I looked up what a virus was. I looked up the most familiar virus I could find, and that was SARS in 2003, and what it did to Chinese GDP. Well, it knocked it down 1%. Now, SARS only infected 10,000 people, and it killed close to 9%. So it was more deadly, but it only affected 10,000 people, yet it knocked Chinese GDP down 1%, and China was the fifth largest economy. So I already knew we were on alert for the tariff damage, but then I was looking at a city in China that was a complete standstill. So I wrote an article on it, and I said, hey, I'm looking at a corona statistics on Worldometers, which was a site that I liked. Worldometers has all the information you want on the virus. And I was looking at 35,000 infections. So I wrote in mid-February, I said, you know, if this thing takes off, people are not taking this seriously enough. This could really do damage to the market. And first, second, third of March, that market started hard down, and with the approval of regulators and well broadcast, it was in my opinion and my actions to take those profits if they existed in the portfolios and pretty much start selling in the first week of March. And well publicized that I started doing that, and it was my opinion only, of course, and not to act on it. And market came apart in the next 3 weeks. It was just bad. And then well-publicized again when the market hit 40% down, the Dow hit 40% down. There is a mathematical sequence called the Fibonacci numbers. You can look that up, Fibonacci. But it also, the Fibonacci numbers also apply to market corrections. And the first Fibonacci number to hit was 61.8%. That's a well-known figure in the Fibonacci sequence, 61.8%. So when it comes to market setbacks, the first turn point of a possible market correction would be down 61.8%. So market fell and fell and fell, and the Dow fell 40%. That's pretty close to 61.8% minus 100 is 38 point whatever it is. And the Dow fell 40% and it stopped. And I went, okay, it stopped at the first Fibonacci correction point and it just sat there. So I figured, okay, well, if we have great profits in the portfolios and we didn't suffer anything, if we did not suffer anything in the correction, then maybe it's time I consider to go on a shopping spree. And well-publicized again, with the approval of regulators, we said we're going shopping in the stock market. And we did. And the rest is history. So now, coming, you know, in March is when the world shut down. And it is now June and California is opening up. Now, I published many articles and on the radio show, I was completely against the shutdowns from the beginning. Now, whether I was right or I was wrong, every time I said that, I get a lot of flack from people that think we should have shut down and maybe even shut down more. And I get kudos from people who said, I agree with you. But I, of my opinion, think we should not have shut down. More damage was done in business, income, families, and deaths from shutting down than from not shutting down. The people that control world hunger and do statistics on these things have come out in many different articles saying many more people will die of starvation because of the shutdowns than COVID will actually kill. Food shortages, I don't quite remember the exact websites that handle it, but just look it up, what the predictions of deaths will be from starvation because of the COVID shutdowns, and they far exceed the numbers, the actual numbers that we know from COVID. So in my opinion, the shutdowns were terrible, terrible, terrible decision. Terrible. More people are going to die from starvation over the long term from shutdowns than ever would be killed from COVID. Additionally, you know, there are countries that shut down and that were mask freaks. Japan, my wife is Japanese. She's actually Brazilian, but she is Japanese from descent. She's a big masker. In Japan, I've been there many times, and they all wear masks. And Japan had their own severe resurgences despite the masks. So it is my opinion that the shutdowns did nothing but hurt more than they helped. And really nobody knows. I know everybody will say, well, we have all sorts of studies saying masks and shutdowns helped. And I can show you all sorts of studies that saying masks and shutdowns don't help. So nobody knows. Everybody says, follow the science. Well, everybody can produce, like they can produce articles that say the market will crash, and an equal number of articles that say the market will scream higher. There are equally number of reports saying that masks and shutdowns helped, and an equal number of reports and studies that say masks and shutdowns don't help. So nobody knows for sure. I know everybody on each side believes they know for sure, but we don't really know. Because we can't have separate universes where we try it the opposite ways and see which one is worse. So we just have to have our opinions, and those are my opinions. So anyway, we are now opening up, and we are finding people are booking cruises, and they're booking airline flights, and they're booking hotels, and all sorts of things. The RV business is booming, and Uber is booming, and Airbnb is booming, and people are traveling. It's kind of funny, during the COVID, people RV'd a lot because you had social distancing automatically, right? Social distancing automatically in an RV, camping and all that. There are, you know, the ballparks. I saw the ballparks are opening up full with full attendance. You know, 60,000 people watching baseball. I'm all for it, man. That's my opinion. I'm all for it. So I flew all over during COVID. I flew all over. I didn't care. Airports were empty, and I loved it. I flew to Los Angeles, Orange County, right in the heart of COVID. And I went to Truckee and Tahoe, and I went to Nevada, Reno, Texas, Mexico twice, and I couldn't catch it. I tried, but I couldn't catch it. And I wore a mask. My wife makes me wear a mask. I got no problem wearing a mask. None. I'm not one of the people that say, if I wear a mask, I'm going to get on the next train to Auschwitz. I don't believe that. People want me to wear a mask, I'll wear a mask. I got no issue with that. Whether I think they help or not, I'm of the opinion that if I have it and I cough and I have a mask, it will help because my cough moisture won't be through the mask. However, if somebody else has it and they cough, it's going in my mask. I had an N95, but still people are wearing these handkerchiefs around their face. I'm like, are you crazy? The handkerchief looks like a freaking chain link fence to a virus. Probably looks like more like a garage door. So, and there's theories that COVID is airborne, at least stays airborne for a certain amount of time. So if you got a mask and it's not an N95 mask that is properly worn, it's my opinion it ain't stopping. So it doesn't help you. I see people wearing masks in the car. I'm thinking, what good is that? But there are many out there that feel differently than I do. And every time I publish something like that, they give me a rash of you know what. But personally, I don't care what kind of rash you give me. That's what I believe, man. But in any case, so the world is opening up. And bless their hearts. I have booked a trip to Disneyland. I may regret that. But they're at 35% occupancy. People have gone there saying, doesn't look like it. Looks like it's full. So I don't know. Maybe I'll regret it. I could only get a spot in July, so I may roast it and be very regretful, but I'm going to give it a shot and do that, and then I'm going to go down to Mexico, San Diego, and wherever else I can go, I'm going to go. In a way, there's a bit of me that is sorry that we are opening up because I love traveling during it because there was nobody traveling, but that's kind of a selfish reason for thinking of that. So, but in any case, the stock market took off from the 18,200s and ran to over 34,000, where it is today. Almost a double in the midst of the worst shutdown in history. Go figure. You know, I know the market looks ahead, but really? So I've been getting nervous since the market hit around 31, 32,000. So in portfolios, I have stops in to get the heck out if this market starts to turn hard, because I ain't giving anything back. No way. Not after the moves I made in early March and mid-March, the buys and the sells at whatever times I did, that yielded whatever amazing results that I may have received in portfolios. You know, I'm not allowed to say that happened. I'll just say may. I'll let you draw your own conclusions. So I'm thrilled that we're all opening up. I hope business gets back to normal, you know. I'm going to cover what I think is going on in the unemployment arena when we return from our break. So you're listening to Money Matters and your community radio station. My name is Mark Cunabrody. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be right back.
We're in the money. We're in the money. We've got a lot of what it takes to get along. We're in the money. The skies are sunny.
And before we get into the unemployment discussion, I just want to touch on fire insurance real quick. Once again, we come into the fire season and calls about fire insurance policies are hitting my phones. I am an agent and owner of an insurance company. I hold California insurance license OL34249 and must tell you that as a disclaimer. But I find homeowners asking good questions and not so good questions, and some are based on misconceptions about what is going on in the fire insurance industry. A long time ago, residential homes were covered under one inclusive policy called an HO3. What that means is that an HO3 covered fire and everything under one policy. What happened with the increase in wildfires, a lot of companies took huge losses, and over time, most companies have elected to remove the fire portion of the coverage from their policies. Incidentally, they removed related coverages to fire, which is lightning, wind, and internal explosion, and some other coverages for a variety of reasons. Insurance companies still offer coverage for your home, but many have removed the fire related risks, as I mentioned. On rare occasions, I will find an insurance company will still offer the all-inclusive HO3 and fire areas, but we don't know why they do that. They have some rhyme or reason on why they do that, but that's usually only known to the insurers themselves. Nowadays, it's more common to have a fire policy and what is called a wrap policy. Some people call it a difference in conditions. That's the proper name for it. The difference in conditions policy is written by your regular insurer if they decide not to write you the fire portion. So if they write a difference in conditions, it covers everything but fire and a few related things that the fire coverage will get, and you'll likely need a fire policy from the infamous Cal Fire. Cal Fire is not a state agency. It's a group of all the insurers that cancel you, all the ones that are doing business in the state, and they operate much like the assigned risk coverage for bad drivers. Basically, Cal Fire is all these insurers grouped together, and they share in the losses and gains of these fire policies, of all the combined policies together. I could argue they may be the most financially bulletproof entity because it's all the insurance companies in one big ball. So unlike some insurance companies that may have gone under due to the massive wildfire losses in recent years in California and other states, Cal Fire members, they can draw upon the resources of the whole group. They're also covered under the California Insurance Association. Many of the phone calls I receive complain about Cal Fire and say they want other options. And I ask them, why don't you want Cal Fire? And they always say the same thing. Well, they're too expensive. When they tell me that, I always respond with the same answer, which is nobody wants to write you a Cal Fire policy because the compensation to agencies, us, may not be commensurate with the other rates that we see. Addition, I say if you're stuck in a hole and only one guy throws you a rope, you don't complain. Your choices are, if you don't like Cal Fire, don't get insurance. And when your regular insurer does come back to California to insure a fire policy for your home, you're probably going to wish you had Cal Fire. That's my opinion, of course. I say this because I know Cal Fire to be highly regulated, scrutinized, and they're skinny on compensations. I don't believe that with the big insurers, my opinion. So if you think the Cal Fire rates are high, you just wait. The trick to navigating this fire insurance fiasco right now is get a responsive agent who will take the time to discuss coverages and your limits and your deductibles and explain how all of that affects your premiums. I hear so many horror stories about agents not returning phone calls or not answering their phones. They're rude, they're short, they don't have time, they tell customers they're busy, or the infamous out-of-state cookie-cutter type agencies which just wing quotes with very little discussion to the client. A lot of people say, well, I got a lowball quote from out of state. Fine. Good luck with that. Best way to make sure that you get the right coverage at the right price, is to work with a knowledgeable local agent, in my opinion, who calls you back, explains the policies, and takes the time to make sure all your questions get answered, and then you get the right limits and right deductibles for the right premium for your situation. There you go. Okay, my two cents. I'll get off my soapbox. We'll be right back to talk about unemployment in the midst of the reopening of America.
On my toes, lots of candy on my mind.
Money Matters. My name is Mark Cuniverti. Welcome to the Opening Up of America show. So a couple of weeks ago, in both articles and shows, I covered how the Employment Development Department, the DDD, the people that send you the unemployment checks, and I stated that their lucrative bonus payments to the unemployed had essentially made the $15 an hour minimum wage debate a moot point. In other words, EDD is paying huge bonuses. Everybody knows that. And before they were doing that, there was a $15 an hour wage debate, minimum wage debate in the United States. And that's particularly what I say right now is no longer a debate. Another contentious debate called the living wage debate. I always see that. You got to be paid a living wage. That will be now likely be turned on its head as the higher wages forced up by the EDD payments will result in exposing the vicious cycle of wage push inflation, which is having its effect on the living wage debate. So let me explain that. The living wage debate, or the minimum wage debate for $15 an hour, has now gone by the wayside. There is no debate because those payments paid by the EDD are now causing even faster inflation in the economy than previously witnessed. And now if you offer $15 an hour, you're never going to get anybody to come to work. It's you now have to pay more, in my opinion. This is wage push inflation, which means businesses are now in many instances offering over $15 an hour to entice potential workers to get off the couch and get back to work. As inflation takes off, I've seen more and more commentary that $15 an hour, which was previously determined by some to approach the so-called living wage, is now grossly inefficient as consumer prices skyrocket. There is a reason why once was what was determined to be at least close to a living wage, $15 an hour, is now quickly being dismissed as grossly deficient by those same people that thought 15 may be close. Plainly put, an economic reality is taking hold. Although higher wages are not the sole cost for higher consumer prices now, commodity prices, with higher wage prices forced up by the EDD payments, are crippling business balance sheets as operational costs soar to these businesses. In a free market environment, businesses will always pass increased costs to the consumer through higher prices, and that is what is occurring. And don't give me this, we'll have to go after business and freeze prices. You can't freeze prices. They don't work. Wage control, price control does not work. Inflation is starting to burn hot, and that is being confirmed by recent government statistics, which say that we have an annual inflation rate of over 4%, and some analysts, including the Federal Reserve chief, says it's probably much higher. It's what happens and why the living wage proponents are calling for even a higher wage as wage rates rise. They now look at the $15 minimum wage. They do some math about what it costs to live and realize $15 will no longer facilitate the, quote, living wage. So the calls go out for an even higher living wage. On the flip side, many argue that the very concept of a living wage is arbitrary, doesn't consider geographic realities like how much it costs to live in New York versus how much it costs to live in Modesto. But I will state that there is a more sinister thing at work here today. As wages rise, consumer prices follow. Therefore, with each increase in the wage rate, inflation rises even more, negating that very same wage increase. That's a vicious cycle familiar to astute economists that says that wages always lag inflation. Because of this, the living wage, I argue right now, is nonsensical, makes no sense. Because as you ask for a living wage, whatever everybody out there thinks that to be, I have no idea what it is, and neither do you. And it's different no matter where you live. Whatever we get to a living wage and you force that wage on businesses, you're going to push consumer costs faster and higher than your living wage, and you will again call for more. You can't catch it. It's a fact, in my opinion. Since it's an accepted fundamental in the study of economics that wages are always lagging to consumer price inflation and also in its occurrence, the argument is put forth here today that the sufficient wage, or what you call a living wage, can never be reached by mandating wages ever higher. In fact, when you do that, when you mandate those higher wages, you are causing the very problem. Inflation will always outrun wages, always. And it is why some find themselves repeatedly calling for an even higher living wage and then wondering why it's never enough. Opponents to the minimum wage mandates argue that you'll never get to a living wage because inflation will always exceed it. I will tell you in the next show how we get around that. But right now, the result is what we see: insufficient wage rates exacerbated by rising prices, which are exacerbated by calling for higher wage rates. Anyway, you don't have to worry. The $15 wage rate is now cast in stone, as you have to actually pay that much to get anybody to work. Okay, that's it for the show. I'm running out of time. I gotta go. Opinions expressed here are my opinions only and not those of any bank or investment advisory firm, nor this station, staff, management, or underwriters. And nothing is meant to ensure a guarantee or be construed as investment advice. Remember, it's my opinion only. Our website is moneymanagementradio.com, where everything is free. Our way of saying thank you for listening to your community radio station. My name's Mark Cuniberti. Have a great day.